The Guardian.
Ar ben y mynydd hwn fe ddoth na grwtsi herio'r byd. I chwerthin yn un ar awel ar graig yn llewis i gris. Ac wrth ringo lan i'r copa hwn ac wrth edrych nôl i lawr. Oedd e'n gwybod yn iawn o'r dechrau, mae dyma i fyd, mae dyma i awr, oedd e yma i aros.
That was the lovely Fleur Dafydd performing The Mountain Song, a tribute to the great Welsh rugby player Ray Gravel, and opening the third of our daily Guardian Haycasts. I'm Claire Armistead, and today we have a Welsh-themed programme. Along with Fleur, joining me today in the House of Hay, is broadcaster and historian Di Smith, who also happens to be chairman of the Welsh Arts Council, and poet and novelist Owen Shears. On this 30-minute programme, we'll be discussing all things Welsh, from language to the Labour Party. We'll have more music from Fleur, some poetry reading from Owen, and...
favourite ingredient, cracked black pepper.
Yes, we'll even be tasting all things Welsh. So the Hay Festival's pretty familiar to all of you three. Owen, you've been coming here since how old?
That's a good question. I think I first came here when I was 14 or 15 years old.
Oh my goodness.
I know, thank you. Which makes me feel very old. So I think this is my 17th or 18th festival. But I actually came because I had entered a competition that the festival had then, which I think it was rather grandly called the All Wales Young Writers Competition. Peter Florence has since told me that only about four people entered, which is probably why I won. But it was really that competition, and it was one of the prizes of that competition that really started me writing, because part of the prize was a week at a writing course up in Tŷ Newydd up in Llanystumdwy, which is actually Lloyd George's old house. And it was a week-long poetry course. And up until that point, I've been sort of trying my hand at short stories.
Up until that point, at the age of 15 or 16?
I suppose in the same way, you know, that lots
of
kids...
They do things very young in Wales.
Well, sometimes, I suppose. But, yeah, it was really that course that sort of kick-started me into writing poetry. So I actually feel a very, very fond attachment to Hay. And since then, I've been here in sort of various guises, from driving cars and sort of doing hospitality... Even did some security, which was kind of ridiculous, being 5 foot nothing. But, yeah, so it's been fantastic to be able to come back so much.
So, Di, how Welsh is it? Do you approve as chairman of the Welsh Arts Council?
Oh, I think it's fantastic that an international festival of this nature is in Wales. And, you know, people have to be reminded that Hay is in Wales because it is on the border. But it's got more Welsh, I think, over the years. I mean, I've known it from the beginning. I knew Peter Florence, if you like, even before Hay, and I knew the family. And I was involved in doing interviews with Peter initially, you know, on radio. And then I think I've done a gig at Hay every year over the 21 years. So for me personally, you know, to be interviewing, as I've done, Norman Mailer, Gore Vidal, Pat Barker, even Peter Mandelson, you know, it's been wonderful that these guys are here in Hay. So yeah, I think it's very Welsh.
Fleur, you're one of the most Welsh bits of it, you could say, couldn't you?
Well, I suppose so.
is the Welsh music scene thriving?
Yes, it is. I think it's quite interesting to come to a festival like Hay, where people maybe have certain preconceptions about, you know, what Welsh language music is. A lot of people seem to think that it's kind of very traditional if it's in the Welsh language. But at the moment, there is a very kind of vibrant Welsh language music scene. So you've got lots of different kind of forms of music that are thriving, very kind of urban forms, which is quite interesting. You know, you've got rap and hip hop and reggae, all in the Welsh language. And I think that's kind of fantastic diversity that's happening at the moment. And I think it's quite interesting to see that flourishing.
I'm Joanna Trollope, and on the train down to Hay, down to Wales from London, I was finishing the most fantastic novel, which won the Orange Prize, called Half of a Yellow Sun.
Well, you can't get more English than Joanna Trollope, can you? But the Welsh are very keen to keep their own language alive, and a few years ago they had a public competition to come up with the Welsh word for television. Fleur, what did they come up with?
They came up with the word teledu.
which I gather someone later discovered actually in Javanese meant stinking badger. Did you know that story?
I didn't know that, actually.
Sounds like most television.
Well, absolutely, yeah.
We might adopt this in cultural criticism of today. Flea, do you prefer singing in English or in Welsh?
I think, it's very instinctive for me to sing in the Welsh language and also to write in the Welsh language. And also it's quite interesting that, there's many more ways of kind of finding a new path, I think, because you know kind of what's gone before, you know what is still to be done in a way. And I find with English, it's much more difficult for me personally to find a voice within that because, you know, of course, there's so much more that's already gone before you.
And you and Owen have been working together you've been translating Owen's work into Welsh. Owen, you also feel that Welsh has affected the way you write, even though you're not actually a Welsh speaker.
Yeah, that's right. I think it has. I mean, I'm somewhat classic of my generation in that, you know, my grandparents were Welsh speakers and my mother was brought up certainly being able to speak Welsh, but sort of maybe slightly within that culture of, you know, sort of nice girls speak English. And then when I went through school in Southeast Wales, there wasn't even Welsh, you know, taught in the school. But yet my younger brother, who is 9 years younger than me, was actually able to go through Welsh medium education. So I am kind of this generational hiccup. So I've sort of felt as though I really missed out. So I've been learning Welsh, but I'm not a fluent Welsh speaker. But having always sort of been around Welsh language and sort of had it, you know, at the edges of my experience, I've always felt very strongly that the rhythms and the sounds of Welsh have certainly informed my poetry, if not my prose. So it's been fantastic, actually, to have Flea working with my poems, because it does kind of feel as though they are being translated back into their roots in a very strong way. So that's been, you know, wonderful for me to see and to hear as well. I must admit, I adore hearing Flea sing in Welsh. I just think that is absolutely her kind of natural medium. I think
tell me the different qualities that each language brings.
Well, I mean, obviously Welsh, it's a language that just seems to sort of, you know, fit in the mouth incredibly well, and it's so full, and it does have this incredible rhythm. And I mean, to even if you don't understand it, I think you can sort of sense what the Welsh might be about. It seems to sort of be able to tap into the tone of a piece very, very well. In the same way, actually, that Flea was sort of choosing certain keys for certain poems, I felt as though even when I wasn't understanding it, I could have told her exactly which poem she was reading.
You really demonstrated the difference between the two languages yesterday at your event when you, Flea, translated some of Owen's poetry live on stage. Can you do it for us now?
Okay, this is a poem that is called Keyways.
Yr allwedd.
Strange then that this should be our last time together.
Rhyfedd felly, mae dyma'r tro olaf.
Standing in line at the locksmith's, waiting for a set of your keys to be cut, so I can visit your flat when you're out and take back all that's mine again.
Ni yn dau yn niwch siop, yn disgwyl y cyfle i mi gael cymryd fy hun fesul gwrthrych yn ôl.
Oh, isn't that lovely?
Hello, this is Gore Vidal, and you are listening to The Guardian.
Haycast.
And so continue to listen until the cows outside this beautiful farmhouse come home.
Gore Vidal was just one of the big names appearing over a packed bank holiday weekend. Despite the pouring rain, people stood in patient lines on sodden duckboards for speakers such as Salman Rushdie and Will Self. If you wanted to learn about the state of the nation, any nation, this was also the place to be. Jimmy Carter.
The president, the next president can change in the first 10 minutes.
And what are the things that president should say?
If the next president takes the oath of office and the Supreme Court justice sits down and the next president walks to the podium and says, while I'm president of the United States, we will never again torture a prisoner.
But there were plenty of literary anecdotes doing the rounds too. Here's what Hanif Qureshi had to say about creative writing courses.
I tell you, the writing courses, the creative, particularly with the word appended, creative, I often think, these are the new mental hospitals. One of the things you notice, I said you should look out for this, whenever you're watching the telly and there's been a shooting on a campus in America, a student has gone mad with a machine gun and shot 30 people, you may be sure it's always the creative writing students that do this, actually.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Pisani, and you're listening to The Guardian Haycast.
Di, let's now turn to you. Raymond Williams, who you've just written a book about, didn't speak Welsh.
No, he didn't, no.
And came from this border country.
Came exactly from Pandy, just outside Abergavenny. His father was a railway signalman, and the family by origin were actually further up into the border country, both Welsh and English.
And was his sense of community important to him?
Hugely so. And he often got, as he put it, smacked for this in England in later life, for being nostalgic and idealistic and romantic. And he kept saying over and over, but it's the way it was. It's the truth. It's the actuality. And I think one of the things my biography shows is that the world he grew up in actually did have that sense of community or collectivity. Values, I think, is a better word, which he took with him throughout his life.
And the tradition of Welshness that he came from was very much that industrialised. His father was a railway man.
Yeah, I mean, there's a sense in which people think that Raymond became Welsh late in life with his discovery of some of the forces of the 1960s and nationalism. But again, what the biography shows, because of my access to his papers, was he's extraordinarily conscious of being Welsh back in the 1940s, and his imaginative fiction is entirely about growing up and living in Wales and thinking about it.
Well, we'll have more from all of my guests, Di Smith, Owen Shears and Fleur Davidh, in a minute. But first, the witty John Crace, author of The Guardian's Digested Read, gives us his digested hay.
I've just walked in from Hay. I am dripping wet. The festival site is actually about half a mile out of town, and you can wait for a shuttle bus, but most of them are full since it's tipping with rain. So I spent 25 quid on a plastic map, and I've walked out here, and I am shivering in the entrance hall. We're just walking through the main thoroughfare. I can just see there's a notice board of venue changes, and it says that events 85 and 86 have been switched, 94, 95 and 101, 102. Now, this may look insignificant and just merely helpful to the audience, but there's a pecking order of writers here, and it means that some writers haven't sold quite as well as others, so they've had to be switched round. But they very tactively just name them as Segovia, Barclays and Guardian, rather than named and shamed the writers involved. Okay, let's dig out the programme and see who's the winners and who's the losers. This is very good news for The Guardian, because our very own Hadley Freeman was switched to the Barclays Wealth Pavilion, which is the biggest tent. Walking down towards the Barclays Wealth tent, we're going past a whole lot of organic furniture, organic food. Well, everything's pretty organic, really.
Tomato soup, please,
with a brown roll. Well, oh, look, there's a fair trade chocolate tasting at 11 o'clock and question and answers. Really, can I have some for nothing? Would be my question. Okay, we're now walking into the bookstore. There's no one actually here signing at the moment, but there is a table full of signed copies. I'm sure all these books will go, but you can see that someone like Joseph Stieglitz has only got one book left, but Elizabeth Pisani and Tom Rob Smith have got much bigger piles, perhaps reflecting the fact that they're harder to shift. So might be fun to check back in a couple of hours' time and see how big the piles are. The festival goers are a very good-natured bunch on the whole, strong on cagoules and other bits of plastic, but I suppose I'm no exception, really. But don't tell anyone.
So, Di, if Raymond Williams had been invited to the Hay Festival, would he have come as a cultural critic or as a novelist?
You know, that's such a terrific question, because it goes to the root, A, of what Williams thought of himself, that there was no divorce in the two ways of writing and thinking for him. And secondly, I think if Hay was an English festival, he'd come as a critic. Because it's a Welsh festival, he'd come as an imaginative writer, and sometimes he'd come as both.
Owen, I know you're a fan of his novels.
Yes,
Tell us a bit about them, because are they in print still?
Well, yes, they are now. Probably his favourite book of mine is a novel called Border Country, which had actually slipped out of print, but then was brought back in through the Library of Wales. So that was republished, I think, 2 years ago. And it's a fantastic novel. It's very much autobiographical, and it really describes the pattern of that, I suppose it was the first generation movement to move from Wales, to go away, to study, and then to crucially move up to London. And it's about a young man who comes back from London to the area where he was brought up after his father dies. His father worked on the railways, just as Raymond Williams' father did. And it's a fantastic novel. It's beautifully structured. There's some fantastic writing about the mountains, about the area. And for me, it was really quite strange because, you know, Raymond Williams went to my school. This book is all about the exact area where I was brought up. And yet, I didn't read it until 2 years ago. So I found it a very moving experience, actually, because I felt in some ways it still even sort of tapped into a pattern that, you know, sort of still happens now, especially when he describes going back to his old town and sort of meeting the people who haven't moved away. I felt a very strong kind of link to that, that specifically kind of South Walian experience as well, because it's so near to London. So there's always been this pretty steady drain up to London, which I think maybe perhaps, you know, somewhere like Scotland hasn't always had in quite the same way.
He thought of himself as a Welsh European, he said, and he said constantly that he wanted to bypass England, bourgeois England, but then he did say, and also bourgeois bloody Wales. I think he's an incredibly important figure for us to recapture as a representative. I keep coming back to this word consciousness. He tells us to be more sophisticated as Welsh people than sometimes we've dared to be, and it isn't just about the going to London stuff. It's actually about where we've come from, you know, what our demographic is, what our rhythms of life have been in the 20th century. And for me to recapture him is actually, I think, to show a path forward.
Flea, I'd like to talk to you a little bit now, because you also have just written a novel which is going to be published this autumn, haven't you?
So that's right, yeah.
You cross boundaries in all sorts of ways.
Well, yeah, this is my first English language novel, and I've written two Welsh language novels previously. But to pick up on something that Di said, I think it is quite interesting that in contemporary Wales now we are seeing, you know, Welsh and English kind of coming together a little bit more. And I think that, you know, that maybe that's symptomatic of the way that we're viewing ourselves in kind of post-devolution Wales, and, you know, this kind of European identity that is emerging. And kind of my background is that, you know, that my parents were kind of Welsh language activists. So I very much grew up in that kind of tradition of protesting. And I think that in a way their kind of battles actually paved the way for me to be able to kind of to write in English, actually, and to not be kind of afraid of the language in a sense, because they kind of had these great triumphs, so that gives you a different kind of courage to use the language, I think. And also what's interesting about, you know, being a Welsh language writer writing in English is that you can kind of say things, you know, about Wales that you can't actually say in a Welsh language book, because, you know, your audience are there, they understand the context. But it's quite interesting, actually, you know, kind of explaining Wales to the world, and also how kind of interesting it is to have that kind of duality, because, you know, as Welsh people we're kind of conditioned that way. We have this duality, this bilingualism. It's kind of our condition, isn't it?
Well, one thing that's definitely Welsh at the Hay Festival is Blas. It's a cafe which specialises in Welsh food, and Kate Taylor took Rose Gray from the River Cafe in West London to meet Nerys Howell, the food consultant for the restaurant, and their chef, Colin Gray, who was soon cooking them up a treat.
We're going to do a little seafood cowl. So we've got some mussels, cockles, smoked haddock from the Black Mountain Smokery, some salmon, some Cariad wine. We've chucked our mussels in.
Leeks.
Would you like some leeks in? Especially for you, Rose. You've got leeks from the really Welsh company.
Wonderful.
I think Welsh cuisine is all about the food, the actual produce. Our terrain and landscape actually dictates what the flavour of the food is on your plate.
Bill of fillet of salmon. Just going to use a couple of nice chunks, really. Quite rustic.
Rose, is Welsh cuisine something that's familiar to you, Welsh ingredients? My sourcing of ingredients is what's best that I can get in this country. So, for instance, I buy Welsh lamb for the River Cafe, which is absolutely fantastic.
OK, so we've got a bit of reduction going on the fish stock and the white wine. Some cream in there now.
Tiny bit French, isn't it?
Bit of French influence and modernise things with a few new flavours.
Do local people here, is there a pride in their local food, Welsh traditional food?
I think as a nation we've taken our food and drink for granted. We don't really appreciate what we have on our doorstep. I think the wheel is turning because other people are interested in it.
Okay, I think that'll do.
Lovely. And it looks beautiful as well, all different colours. Pink are the salmon, green broccoli and...
That's it, guys. Dig in.
What's the verdict?
Yeah, absolutely delicious. Extraordinary the way the cheese actually sort of melts in and blends with the lava bread. Mm. It's delicious way. It's excellent.
It's a real treat.
Yeah, that was very interesting, Colin.
You're welcome.
I like the way you cook. I do.
Rose Gray and Neris Howell sampling the cooking of Colin Gray at the Blass Cafe. So, lava bread. Do any of you like lava bread particularly? Can you describe it?
I have to be honest, it's been a long time since I've had some lava bread, actually. But when I did like it, yeah.
It's the Welsh caviar, isn't it?
I've stepped in it a few times.
Yeah, I was going to say, I've sort of emerged from the sea covered in it.
It is thick and black, and it's... comes from the sea. That's probably all you need to know, isn't it?
Miscellaneous bits of grit, I think.
Oatmeal and bacon, they say, and cockles.
Does Welsh food travel well? Owen, do you get it in New York, where you live now?
Yes, we do, actually. Funny enough, we just recently had a Wales Week in New York, which might not be quite as a large event as St. Patrick's Day, but it was pretty impressive this year. And it was interesting how the Welsh Assembly government, it seemed to me, actually chose to very much lead the way with Welsh food and drink. They did a very successful event called Wales on Wall Street, where they brought over several Welsh chefs and were serving, you know, the kind of food that we've just been hearing about. There's also a Welsh whiskey called Penderyn, which is doing very well. It's sort of described as a Welsh gold, I think. And that's been doing very well in America, I think, so far. It's quite strange for me because Penderyn was actually my mother's village, so I've always just associated, you know, with this small village up in Merthyr. And suddenly, you know, I see it in these shops on Park Avenue as this fantastic whiskey. So actually, that's made me feel very, very proud. Yeah.
I like the fact that the wine was called Cariad. What does that mean?
That means love.
It means love. Isn't that the loveliest thing?
I think, yeah, Welsh produce has been very successfully branded overseas. I mean, you know, Owen was talking about Penderyn and also very successful brands like, you know, Hallen Morn, Anglesey Sea Salt, which is kind of distributed internationally. And it's kind of a great way of kind of branding Wales abroad, if you like. So it's kind of doing that work and giving it an identity.
Hello, I'm Lisa Pignanese, and you're listening to The Guardian Haycast.
Now, you mentioned Wales as a European country, and I know the Irish certainly think of themselves as a European country. Do you think this is true of the Welsh now, that you feel you're part of Europe as opposed to part of Britain?
No, not entirely. I think that in some senses the Welsh might be the last of the British. I think the Welsh don't like being called Brits any more than the Irish would. I mean, I think one of the most astonishing things in my lifetime is the way in which the English have accepted this term of abuse, Brits, abuse in the mouths of Irish people or Americans, and are quite happy to call themselves Brits, whereas Irish people, Scots and certainly the Welsh, would not like to be thought of as Brits. And yet, I think that we are tied into a Britishness in the 20th century by things like wars, you know, by social class and by intermarriage. I mean, the biggest minority in Wales, after all, are the English.
I think we are just starting. I mean, I see myself, you know, I'd like to view myself as European, and I think, you know, kind of, you know, that sense of kind of bypassing England and Britishness, and you know, we are kind of starting to kind of battle against that. And I think, you know, our kind of works of art also are kind of embracing that type of thinking. And I feel that, especially within kind of Welsh language, kind of fiction, if you like, there's more an embracing of kind of European traditions, and not necessarily always having to write in that Welsh context. We're looking further afield, and we're looking at, you know, new ways of defining ourselves.
I feel it might be right as well if you think of the Labour Party, which is the last great unionist party, and of course in Wales has represented that kind of Britishness as I described it historically. Now, if the Labour Party truly is passing out of history, then I think not just the politics of Wales or of the UK, but those other concepts of Britishness are going to be held up for inquiry. I mean, the Britishness that is historically based is real. The Britishness that is foisted upon us, even by a prime minister who would like to derive values from it, is so clearly phony that he's got to think again. And in that sense, the European issue is, I think, one that the Welsh, and particularly younger generation of Welsh people, are going to grapple with increasingly.
And of course, all the Welsh mining valleys now are no longer Labour, which was very shocking to me, having lived here in the 1980s.
Well, I mean, in the local, there are two local authorities that are still Labour controlled. I think it's too early to say, to be frank. It's too early to say which way things are going to go. I mean, in Gwynedd, Plaid also lost control of the council. And what you've got in Wales at the moment is this incredibly interesting phenomenon of independents, who are either the people's voice in Blaenau Gwent, or mavericks like Ron Davies coming back into politics, or people, you know, forming coalitions. What you're seeing is the ice flow cracking, but I don't think anybody's yet clear which way the water's then going to flow.
Which brings us back, actually, to Raymond Williams and true originality of thought, which seems to be a Welsh characteristic.
I can't say no to that, can I?
How's that? How's that? How's that for flattery?
That sounds fine by me.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, that's about it for today's Haycast. Thanks to my guests, Di Smith, Flea David, Owen Shears. Tomorrow we'll be looking at where children's books are in the age of the Xbox, with Francesca Simon, Owen Colfer and Lem Sisse. But to play us out today, Owen and Flea are going to perform Rehearsal. Well, that's what Owen calls it. Flea calls it Reciting Broken Becket.
Yes, I appropriated Owen's poem. I had quite good fun, actually, pulling the poem apart. And Reciting Broken Becket is one of the lines of the poem, and it becomes this kind of motif for the song because it's very much a song about performance. It was the director's idea to take the speech into the park and blind you with that in-flight mask, to leave you cross-legged, the backs of your hands resting on your thighs, reciting broken Becket into the dark behind your eyes. Reciting broken Becket into the dark behind your eyes, behind your eyes.
It was the director's idea to take the speech into the park and blind you with an in-flight mask, leaving you cross-legged, the backs of your hands resting on your thighs, reciting broken Becket into the dark behind your eyes. So they had to tell you later how the man, ragged with rough sleeping, rose from the bench where he'd lain all night to walk over and stand before you on the verge of interrupting.
So they had to tell you later how the man, ragged from rough sleeping, rose on the bench where he'd been sleeping and stood up to stand before you on the verge of interrupting. Reciting broken Becket into the dark beneath his heart. Reciting broken Becket into the dark beneath his heart. Beneath his heart.
He never did, but watched instead a one-man standing ovation, so proving again the rehearsal to be no more than the performance already begun. When you stopped, he started and carried on as if it had, after all, been just a pause button pressed. So when you uncovered your eyes, he was gone.
When you stopped, that's when he started. Carried on as if it had been just a pause button pressed. So when you uncovered your eyes, he was long gone. There was just the summer park, the river slouching slowly past, a meter or so before you, two pale patches in the grass, as you recited broken Becket into a day that never asks. Reciting broken Becket into a day that never asks for more than rehearsal, more than rehearsal.
There was just the summer park, the river slouching past, and a meter or so before you, two pale patches in the grass, as if a couple had brushed against the velvet of their seats while leaving the stalls before the bowing of the cast.
more than rehearsal.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.